Hello and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures podcast presented by NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project in collaboration with Shoshimworks, a global firm helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping society, industry, economy, and policy, and reframing how we build for resilient futures. Today, we're thrilled to launch our third season, in which we're investigating the ways that AI is informing industry and society, or how we design pathways to systemic resilience. So much of what we hear about AI today focuses narrowly on the promise and peril of generative AI. In contrast, our podcast series will expand the exploration to a comprehensive review of the AI arena, pressure test hype versus reality, and seek to understand where practical applications of these capabilities are shaping ecosystemic futures. Okay, everyone. Today, I'm joined by two of our co-hosts, Ed Powell, the CEO of TensorX, and James Villarubia, White House Innovation Fellow and Digital Strategist for the NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project. And we're also excited to welcome to the podcast Mark Stephen Meadows as our new NASA co-host. Mark, why don't you share a little bit about who you are and your background?
Hi, yeah, it's great to join you guys today. Thank you very much for having me. I'm coming from probably about two decades of work within artificial intelligence and virtual reality or extended reality, and I'm an author, I'm an artist. I'm serving as the science fiction writer for Convergent Aeronautics Solutions and bring a background as a sailor of 17 years. I'm a U.S. Coast Guard 100-ton captain, and I'm delighted to be joining you guys and bringing a traveled perspective, occasionally technical, artistic, and hopefully a little bit divergent. Thank you very much for having me.
Fantastic. So excited to have you join us. And everyone, welcome today. This is going to be a fun conversation. As you all know, we're going to be diving into the world of AI. We have an entire series dedicated to different facets of the AI world. And really today, we'll just kind of shape up what that will look like through this season. And really, I think a great way to kick this off, because we've all heard so many headlines and stories about what AI is, what it isn't, what it is doing, what it might do. And it's really developed a kind of a persona. Folks are really kind of treating AI as its own thing. It's been around for quite some time and has many tentacles in society, industry, and policy. But a lot of the hype is exceeding the applications, the practical applications. So today, I hope that we can kind of some of this down and really kind of frame up what we think how AI will shape the next 5, 10, 15, 50 years for society, industry, and policy. So maybe, team, let's just dive into this. Folks are beginning to kind of treat AI as its own thing, but that tends to inflate what it is and what it can be at this moment. How do we start to walk that back and really kind of think about that in practical terms?
Well, I can kick this off. First, I want to say, Mark, so excited to have you join our team. It's been a real pleasure working with you in the last year or so with CAS. It really helped shape our and my ideas on AI, bringing your experience. So, again, really excited to have you join us. But to Diane, on your question around sort of how we distinguish this, I think we're sort of stuck in this strange moment where there hasn't been enough edification and experience with AI to sort of give people a reference point about how we talk about it, what it isn't, what it can't do. Because most of the people I think using AI right now are sort of new to the space, whereas I think probably everyone on this call has been dealing with AI in its various sort of poor performing forms for a while. And at the same time, so we've got this sort of educational gap, we've also got this anthropomorphizing of AI, which is adding to the problem of the sort of broader idea, oh, AI is this grand, great, infinite wisdom thing. And again, those of us who have been working in this field know that is not true, but trying to convince people who don't understand the technology to also understand sort of its limits and sort of gaps, sort of a two two big problems that we are facing just as a technologist community, much less a society. So I would love to sort of know, Ed and Mark, what your thoughts are.
So it seems like we had this discussion yesterday about the fact that AI is really about making predictions and about those predictions becoming increasingly accurate and in some ways increasingly less expensive to perform. And so when I think about it, the fact that in the original perceptor model, you have a set of inputs and you're trying to use those to predict something. And then you have the backpropagation, which then allows you to train it. And then you have unsupervised learning where you let it kind of auto-organize around certain themes. And now with the generative AI and the transform models, what's interesting is you're essentially still predicting. You're just predicting the next word. That could be a million next words, but you're predicting words. I think there's a whole host of concepts that have to be dealt with in terms of people kind of understanding limitations. But then also, I wonder for Mark, as you think about creativity, as you think about producing new works of art or new linguistic pieces or new music, for example, how should we think about intellectual property? How should we think about ownership? How should we think about the various components that are kind of important to concepts of author and ownership and creativity and having the, in essence, credit for what you've created in a world where there's this high level of augmented reality, augmented intelligence, and artificial cognition?
Yeah, thanks. I mean, it's interesting. You remind me of the book that Jeff Hawkins wrote, I don't know, a decade ago, maybe, on intelligence, and talking about the ability, what intelligence might be is the ability to predict. And what artificial might be, when we add these pretty rich terms on top of each other, it gets very hard to distinguish really what we're talking about, right? Is artificial intelligence a kind of a cultural method of building predictive models? I'm always interested to see that in the history of NASA, the role that computers had and people as computers, as people working at their desks with pencils and paper, they're storing and processing data and really predicting things. So I think that there's something important here. Now our computers crash as much as they predict, I guess, but it seems as though we're moving towards something that's more fluid in a cultural space of prediction. Like the language models and transformers as the new addition to them are great. This kind of a vector space, to me, is the thing that's important to understand, is that we're dealing with this three-dimensional space and we can take all of the different ideas within an intellectual property and put it within that volume. There might be a token in that space for Diane and a token in that space for Ed and one for James and Mark and Reed. And we can say that we, as the concept within that volume, own those particular spots, own that particular property. But within the computation and the prediction model that we're using, especially when we apply transformers, those things get really liquid and we begin to suddenly have a whole new space within there. But there might be a combination of James and Ed, and a combination of Diane and Mark, and suddenly we're like, wow, this is a whole new way of thinking about what could be. But it's the cultural framework, the artificial component maybe, or the art, the cultural piece that allows us to then have some value within those predictions that are being built, which I really find fascinating, because that, as a collective unconscious, as all of us combine our thoughts, whether we mean to or not within these systems, we find that just like our own roles in the world, maybe there's value there that we can reevaluate. Curious to hear a little bit about, James, some of the work that NASA has been doing, the role of prediction there at a very high level. Do you see LLMs and vector spaces as providing new inspiration for the engineers and the people that used to be computers today, or do you think that it's going to be just like a pocket calculator that we use and this is going to be there for some numbers? What kind of role do you foresee?
I mean, I think that's exactly the kind of work that we're sort of focused on and trying to get inside government, because I'm sure there's private sector groups doing this. Government always trying to do it safely and get things, but you know, behind the wall, as it were. But a lot of the work is exactly what you're talking about, Mark. It's trying to find those white spaces that are hard to see, that have been hard to see for humans for a long time. And when you start talking about white spaces for problems that are by definition hard to define, sort of the wicked complex problems where you need 10 PhDs in a room to just start talking about it, to rationalize around it. Trying to find that white space, trying to find interconnections gets much harder. And that's, I think, the beauty of AI. And one of the things you mentioned around some of these conversational avatars about some of the token for Diane, the token for Ed, it sort of made me think that maybe a good way to explain this is that if I could, right now people are making sort of avatars of themselves, and that's a, you know, cool, hip thing to do right now. People do posting about it on Twitter. Oh, here's the AI version of me. We can imagine that if you've got that AI version of Diane and the AI version of Mark or James or Ed, you can then say, okay, well, what about the combination of two? Where in that sort of infinite space between them was like, well, could I combine those personalities? Could I combine that knowledge? And now I've got the amalgamation chimera of Diane, Ed, and Mark all as one. Okay, well, what does that bot say? What is that opinion? Which ideas win out? Which ideas were sort of subtly actually all agreed upon that we just didn't know that we can sort of draw out? And now you can imagine, well, how can I pull in researchers? How can I pull in all of humanity, every person's idea? And that's where you get to this latent knowledge of humanity that we are pulling into these LLMs really is just sort of the writings of all of these people, all of these authors throughout time. We just pulled in and say, great, your idea and your idea all sort of merge together. We're sort of pulling on that. So it is not interesting sort of AI as this non-anthropomorphized thing. It is not infinite knowledge, but it is knowledge. It is knowledge sort of merged of all of these people. And I goes back to Ed, your idea of like, well, who owns that then? If we've got 300 million separate authors over time having written things in various languages all combined, who owns the output of that sort of merged identity? And right now, the answer is no one owns it. It is not copyrightable, which might be a good strategy moving forward. But it does sort of speak to this broader idea. And I think sort of back to Mark, to your point, I think what NASA is trying to figure out is how can we use that sort of idea, maybe not broadly for all knowledge of humanity, but how do we tap into the experts in these sort of really complex spaces and say, hey, can we at least get these 10 people or these 10 sources to sort of merge together and then draw out unique ideas that no one has put together yet? And if we can do that, then we can sort of stay ahead of some of the problems because we can be more creative. We can think about these sort of interesting futures that no one has literally considered before and do it at speed. We don't have to have whole conferences. We can generate ideas one after the other very quickly with AI. And with that power, we can hopefully sort of solve some of these problems a lot faster. So it is an interesting space.
So that's a really interesting point about this kind of tokenization and attribution. One of the things that kind of hits me is the fact that we have a science fiction writer on the NASA strategic planning team. So one of the things with, as I think about the architecture of large language models, and this is true, by the way, in lots of things that related to neuroscience, it turns out that, for example, in dealing with PTSD, one of the primary substances is actually psychedelics. And the reason it's psychedelics is because psychedelics actually increase neuroplasticity. And neuroplasticity, then, you still have to go back and retrain the network, but you're changing essentially the topology of the network. And so I'd love for Mark to maybe address this question about kind of his view of how, as a science fiction writer, you become, I presume you're bringing in ideas that aren't part of the standard peer-reviewed academic literature in science and nature, but you're bringing disruptive ideas that shake up the network and cause the network to rethink certain things in different ways. And I kind of think about large language models like that, because if the things are more segmented into kind of specific areas, one, you have more traceability, which gives at least a guy like me more confidence that I understand why it's telling me what it's telling me. And then the fact that you could also then kind of interject the science fiction writer component of the large language model that would go and shake up the work.
Yeah, you remind me of someone named Skip Rizzo, who was working at a medical division of UCLA. I met Skip around like 2015, maybe 2014, and he was working with veterans who had very severe cases, I suppose we say, of PTSD, and was working with conversational avatars as a therapy methodology, specifically saying, here is a synthetic person, and if you speak with them, you can say whatever you want. They're not going to be judging you, and they're not going to be evaluating whether what you said is okay or not. And I thought it was a really, I was honored to be able to learn from some of that. what I began to see too was that the cultural reflections that were being shared between the avatar and the veteran were really important, both to Skip as a researcher, his whole team there that was working with versions of, and that was natural language processing system before we had transformers. So we had a lot of it that was pre-scripted. You had to like draw out the entire tree of conversational possibilities. And if the vet would start talking about something that just wasn't in the system, you could end up with some really awkward snags. But I began to see in this reflection, really, sort of a person looking at a version of themselves in the mirror of the avatar. Okay, look, my background a little bit. I worked as an artist in residence at Xerox PARC, which is a research institute that has invented things like the graphical user interface and the mouse. And that was great. I had to work with Mark Weiser, one of the inventors of what I guess we call today the Internet of Things. And as an artist in residence there, they said, your job here is to invent. That's the role that artists have now within the technology sphere of work. And having traveled strange places, visiting Baghdad when it was being looted, or spending time interviewing the guys that invented suicide bombing and writing a book about that, I just collected more and more strange kind of outlier experiences. And as an artist, there are other experiences that I've collected too, kind of like an LLM. I'm like, oh, I like the artist Egon Schiele, and I really like the writer Philip K. Dick. And these are pieces that I kind of collect, that I agglomerate, and then I can take these along. And so James and I will be talking about a particular problem, such as how do we deal with climate change? How do we deal with climate refugees? And then I can bring in some ideas that might be from a field, and then we can work with experts and take what might be 80% fiction and 20% science and turn it into more like a 50-50 composition, where I think sometimes also we're doing a lot of engineering fiction. But what that does, it helps us look into the cultural mirror of ourselves, whether we're traumatized veterans or whether we're stepping out like Neil Armstrong on the moon for the first time, to be able to see what, through that new lens, reflecting back on ourselves and all the different kinds of experience, where do we go from here? Which I'm really excited to be able to do. It's really challenging. And I have to bring to bear all of the engineering and science background that I have to be able to work on good fiction. And James read something the other day. He was like, I read the whole piece. I said, well, did you enjoy it? I realized that's the key in some ways. Like, if we're not enjoying the work we're doing, we're not going to really do a good job. Whether it's authoring all of the little insertions of a token space and training up the voice models or the vision models, or whether we're trying to predict what the future might be, I think it still boils down to contextual cultural assimilation. All we're really doing, all of us, is basically like an LLM packing together ideas and then trying to find the most appropriate organization as we go forward into the future, which is, you know, where we live most of our lives. That makes sense?
Yeah, I certainly think I understand where you're coming from, Mark. And I don't want to sell you short. I really enjoyed your piece. I thought it was really good. But it brings to mind some considerations of sort of why NASA was interested in bringing in someone like you with a sci-fi background. And I think one of the things we sort of recognized was that drawing from, call it, design theory and creativity theory, one of the limitations is that if you stay in the same room, then learn a lot of things, you won't bring in new ideas. You won't be sort of inspired by new things. You have to, as we say, there's an acronym, NAHITO, nothing interesting happens in the office. You have to get out. You have to be inspired to sort of upset the stable balance. We don't have to necessarily go that far. And I think one of the things that Mark and I, you and I have had this conversation around sort of, and what we're trying to reflect in some of the work we're doing together at NASA, is that good sci-fi doesn't necessarily have to be technobabble. And you, I'm sure a lot of our audience has read sci-fi with a lot of invented words and this, you know, intense, complex universe where the author is injected, call it 10, 15 new inventions. And it's sort of silly. It's not really an interesting story. The best stories, and my favorite sci-fi, certainly, and where we try to think of, is what if one thing changed, one critical invention changed, and then follow that out into, Mark, what you were saying, sort of the cultural shifts. What then, what do people do? What do people do? Not what other inventions follow, but what do people do? How do we respond as a culture to that change? I think Asimov famously wrote, what, 340 some odd pieces of work, all in the same universe, based off of the idea of what happens if we invent AI? What happens if we have real robots? And what is sort of amazing is that his early work, iRobot in the 40s, predicted a lot of what we're dealing with today pretty spot on, because he just took one idea of AI and just examined people. And people are actually pretty predictable. We responded in a lot of the same ways. And you can think of sort of Richard Morgan and the Altered Carbon series. He looked at what if people's consciousness could be stored on a disk separate from their body. Well, okay, well then people can effectively live forever. You can imagine people trading bodies and designing organic, as they say, sleeves and swapping. And if people can live forever, then how do you deal with issues of, you know, of law and order? How do you maintain control over infinite wealth and people who can sort of live forever? What does it mean to sort of murder someone if, you know, their consciousness actually persists after their body is gone? And those are the parts that make the story really interesting, because it's still war, it's still conflict, it's still poverty, but in the context of this one technical change. And I think, Mark, what, you know, like, I've really appreciated your work on the team is trying to inject and figure out, like, what are, you know, not only what are those technologies, we have a lot of engineers who can help with that, but what then follows? What are the cultural norms, the Egon Schiele strange things that we can bring in to say, hey, this is what we did before. Hey, here's some art that might inspire how we think about those second and third order effects to culture and society. And that's where I think hopefully we are going at NASA in this project. And hopefully part of the reason we explore in this podcast is how do we get all these new ideas, particularly now in the season around AI, to help inspire change and think about how do people react to this technology, not just where the technology goes next.
I mean, it seems to me as a good future projection has to be based on the past. If we look at the normal things we do during the day, wake up, eat, talk to people, go to the bathroom, wear clothes, like, you know, breathe, ride around in vehicles, those are things that people will be doing in 1,000 years. Should people still continue to exist as we imagine them today? And so, one of the things I love about a lot of contemporary science fiction, Ted Chiang comes to mind, for example, is trying to use history as a lens to scope forward. I have a background in history. I'm a big fan of Attic and Homeric Greek. I still translate it on a kind of hobbyist basis. And from that, I can kind of get these little threads of the old ways that things used to happen. And then I'm like, while I'm fixing my eggs in the morning, I'm like, I'm eating something that people have been eating for thousands of years. It's like breakfast of eggs and bread is really old. And then suddenly I can somehow understand what's going to happen in the next 1,000 years. But there's a piece here which I find curious, which is that if we consider artificial intelligence, I have this kind of a binary flip happening right now, because I can see it on one level being very much like a calculator, like the Pocket calculator I mentioned earlier. And it's a thing that we will have and we will use to great advantage to estimate all kinds of trajectories. Maybe it will be, and I kind of like this thinking, that artificial intelligence will sit next to us, kind of like the calculator the abacus has for the last couple thousand years. Mathematics, if it's something that's been invented, is a thing that certainly helped us predict. And it hasn't really changed how we eat our eggs in the morning, right? But the part that confuses me, and I think all of us with artificial intelligence, is now that AGI is right around the corner, a system that's able to participate in this conversation with the same prosody and intonation, anticipations, cultural references that we do, let's say, something that can tell a joke, that will be a thing we will see within our lifetime, certainly, maybe just within the next couple of months. Like OpenAI, whatever, $500 billion valuation, like they're sitting on some strange technology, let's face it. They have access to the best people, the best tools. Is it going to say, no more eating eggs? Human beings are no longer going to be around. We're going to get rid of the hyper-aggressive alpha males that have been like causing wars and problems all throughout history. We're going to breed out traits of, they're like traits of morality, or maybe they're traits of intelligence, or maybe they're traits of selfishness. And the AI will say, we're going to sign everybody up now for this new program, and your children will all be subjected to it, and we're the new benevolent overlords. And the problem that I'm having with the pocket calculator or the benevolent overlord scenario is that I don't find a lot of difference between the two. And that gray space and that inability that I have to predict indicates to me that what we're sitting on right now, what we're seeing is a really historic moment, really something much more like the invention of language than the invention maybe of math.
I think, yeah, no, I've been hearing a lot of fretting about overlords and AI robots. And I think I want to step back from that a little bit, but I take your point, Mark, that the way I've been thinking of it is I used to, when I was teaching sort of digital policy at the graduate level, I would try to introduce my students who are not technologists to this idea of the DIKW framework. So there's data out there, it gets filtered down, sort of connected tissue, becomes information. Then it becomes sort of knowledge out of that information, eventually wisdom. And sort of wisdom is the ultimate sort of fully contextualized understanding of sort of that raw data. And humans, we're really good at sort of traversing that input. We do it sort of naturally. Our brains are designed for that. And up to now, AI and even machines have really been focused on that data to information step, D to I. And we started seeing a little bit stretching from I to K, that knowledge, okay, is can we actually extract knowledge from information? Is AI good at that? And where I get sort of terrified or a little worried is that I think what you're talking about is the step we're taking is that I to K to W, that there might be a moment near term where AI knows more than we do about stuff that we care about. You can absolutely imagine, you're like, as a silly example, an AI being funnier than you. I want to be a stand-up comic and the AI just writes better jokes than I can. And maybe the jokes are bawdy, but like the AI is like, hell, I describe the audience, the AI writes really great jokes. And that's a little alarming as a human. It's like, well, like, where does creativity then lie? Where does my value as a comedian? And now take that example and expand it into other areas, which may be more important parts of our society or our economy than the GDP produced by comedians. But you can imagine how we get to this sort of scary, oh, what is our purpose here, existential crisis, even before we get to the robot overlords. Just the, what do we do when AI is better at just being what we want to be, knowing what we want to know than we can be? So, I mean, Ed, I think you think about these systems levels questions a lot. Like, what are your thoughts?
My question was actually if most of Mark's work tends to be utopian or dystopian. Because I think ultimately I'm the red team, blue team guy. I think that systems that are anti-fragile and you pound each other and you figure out how to make each other better is actually a better approach. And I love the idea of having a science fiction writer, artist who was thinking in a completely different way to bring in and shock the network and drive neuroplasticity. Because I just think that that's so critical in not getting locked into this kind of, yeah, it's just a key part of like cognitive behavioral therapy for the integrated network. And I think for me, that's the thing that I find the most encouraging.
Yeah, you can call me LSD, I suppose, right? Instead of MSM. I got a robot walks into a bar. It asks for a screwdriver. Okay, sorry. James, don't get me started on the comedy shtick.
I think AI can write a better joke than that.
The thing about utopian, dystopian, Ed, I grew up in, as I guess most of us on this call, an era of dystopic fiction. The breakdown of the industrial complex or the military-industrial complex in the United States, I think, really reflected this, like, oh, there's something bad happening. And I've actually, as James can testify, I will go through and in scenarios that I'm generating, work on each. And I think that there's more of a need for us to have a utopic outlook as fiction writers, that what we need to do is say, let's cast in front of us an ability to think in a different way. Because if we just think, I don't know about you, and like if I'm practicing, I just learned how to ride a unicycle. I got the electric unicycle lately and I'm learning how to ride it. I realize if I think I'm about to fall, that's when I fall. Right. So it might be that there's a responsibility in crafting these things that we have to say, here's a way of thinking in the future that's utopic. I think that there's something about also for each of us here working in AI as long as we have, I think it's very important for us to keep these kind of AI moments to watch. What's ahead of us in the future? What do we see as being moments that will be key? And I have to say, I wrote a book called iAvatar, thinking about this iRobot situation and looking at us each as robots now. As we evolve, wearing glasses or using these computers, we all are cyborgs. And I think for me, the AI moment to keep an eye on up ahead, it has to do with humor. I think that there's a real intelligence and cultural flexibility within humor. And when I'm watching two AI systems in conversation, trading jokes, that is for me going to a moment where I'm going to probably close my computer and go fix an egg. I wonder for you guys, what will be a moment, like what do you have any benchmark moments up ahead that you are watching, waiting for? What would be something that would just cause you to really pause and say, we've crossed an important line here?
Yeah, I'll jump in and hand it over quickly to the rest of the team. But I think I am fascinated with the augmentation of human intelligence and the human experience with these emerging technologies, whether that is at the individual level where I can augment my own capabilities and extend what I know and who I am ad infinitum, right? Or if we can architect some really interesting studies out there on collective superintelligence. And I think coupling the wisdom of the crowd with AI and emerging technologies could offer a new horizon of kind of conventional wisdom and paradigm that we haven't yet been able to achieve, because we're working with too constrained systems that are much too constrained, either by individual intelligence or individual technologies. But if we start to combine the wisdom of the crowd with the wisdom that can be codified and unlocked in AI, I think it could be really exciting. So maybe over to you, James, and then we'll wrap it up with you, Ed.
I think this actually came out of one of our earlier episodes. So if you're listening, go back and find it. The watershed moment for me, I think, is going to be the economic disruption ones, because I'm not super worried about an AI making a comedian sad, but I am worried about an AI being better at running a business than most board members. So I think the moment an AI or an AI model is recognized as formally as the owner, creator, or board member or C-suite member of a company that has gotten funding, that to me is when it's getting real and that our economy is headed for a real turn or disruption, whatever you might call it. Ed, over to you.
Yeah, I agree. I think when I think of life in kind of a Maslow's hierarchy, I'm thinking about certain levels of things I get concerned about. Like if all of a sudden the grid starts getting taken down by AI, I would be, that's the kind of thing, right? That's a DEFCON 5. So when I think about it, I think about that in kind of these layers in like a subsumption architecture kind of way. Like how do we keep safety at a certain level, but then maintain freedom to be able to go and develop the models holistically and being driven by kind of markets and economic competition. But I think it's a very exciting time. And I'm frankly excited about continuing to see how it changes how we humans interact with it. I'm reminded of the fact there's a New York article about how Google has made us more stupid. With generative AI, we might not just become more stupid. There might be other things about us that we begin to augment with artificial intelligence that goes beyond just our stupidity.
And on that enlightening note, this is really, I think, a renaissance moment for humanity. We have the potential and, frankly, the responsibility to unlock what's next for humanity with these tools. And I'm really excited that this team is thinking about those potential futures and helping to solve some of the wicked opportunities in front of us. So again, with that, gosh, that time moved so quickly. We're going to have to wrap it up for now, but please do stay with us for the rest of this series. We are going to be diving deep into AI and different facets and futures that AI can unlock. Thank you, everyone, and we'll talk soon.
Thank you.
Thanks again. Thanks.
Thanks again, everyone, for joining us today. And please do check out this season's new episodes to join our discovery journey as we explore the AI arena, pressure testing hype versus reality, and understanding where practical applications of these capabilities are shaping ecosystemic futures. Follow us and subscribe on Apple Podcasts for your favorite place to access podcasts. And you can always learn more at shushumworks.com.